You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Oh wow, it's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Cheers MOTAT, and kia ora Marcus.
Kia ora, how are you doing?
I'm great, how are you?
I'm okay. A little bit damp today.
All right. Well, first up, we've got QAnon and conspiracy theory research. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so the more observant of you may have noticed a certain lack of a President Trump in America. And researchers are trying to catch up with all the information and disinformation and misinformation and how it was spread on social media, and trying to figure out what we can learn about the conspiracy theories and things like that, that basically Trump turned upside down. Because I think before Trump, there always could have been conspiracy theories, but they've always sort of been bubbling under, and the number of active conspirators, I guess, are usually fairly small. But Trump really turned this upside down. He put the conspiracy theories into the mainstream. And researchers are trying to figure out what the effect of this is and how they could be taken advantage of by other potential politicians, and what we can do about it. So how do we retool and rebuild and prepare for what's coming after Trump? Trump Mark II, or
yeah,
oh God,
oh God forbid.
Yeah. So yeah, during his presidency, obviously he regularly retweeted followers and a link to notorious conspiracy theories such as QAnon. That's one that originated about 4 years ago, and it claimed that a powerful group of Democrats and elite people in the U.S. were trafficking and abusing children,
right.
And that Trump was the hero fighting them and to rid the country of these people. Trump never endorsed QAnon, but he repeatedly refused to condemn them or condemn the conspiracy theory, and he at least once praised its followers for their support. So there's debates in the sort of the conspiracy theory research community, and one of them is whether Trump has pushed more people into QAnon or into these sort of conspiracy theories, or whether he's just emboldened those who already believed. Yeah, in other words, they sort of feel more confident to come out of the shadows and shout louder and make their voices heard. And so there's a lot of research now. People are really trying to catch up because the spigot has been turned off. Trump has been silenced. And so it's sort of time to play catch up and look back on what's happened. And there is an increasing, because Trump was so vocal about these things, there's an increasing belief now that he not only emboldened those who already believed, but he really managed to push more people into QAnon with his sort of incessant tweeting. And obviously things came to head on the 6th of January when Trump told attendees at the big rally in D.C., if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore. And he called them to march on the U.S. Capitol, and that was just as Congress was preparing to certify Joe Biden as the next U.S. president. And sort of this false narrative about the election was a sort of a landmark opportunity for researchers to study how disinformation spreads across the internet. And the team, there's so much information out there. The teams are still sifting through all this data, but it's starting to illuminate how social media makes it possible for populist leaders such as Trump to build these constituencies and wield power. So there's one case, for example. Researchers tracked false claims that Sharpie pens, those are little black Sharpie pens, given to voters in Illinois and Arizona, resulted in damaged ballots that were unreadable by voting machines. This was a conspiracy theory, and seeded by Trump's narrative about election fraud, these claims originated among his supporters on Twitter, and then were amplified by members of his own family, right-wing influencers, and others, to helping to spread the message further and bring it into the mainstream. And you may have noticed that there were all these efforts to set the record straight on Twitter and Facebook, sort of claiming, sort of attaching warning labels to prominent tweets. But they think this really failed because the narrative spread anyway as these grassroots level sort of conspirators from a lot of unverified accounts sort of just spread these stories. And what's more, the mass media picked up on a lot of these stories and broadcast them as well. So Fox News and other places, Newsmax and other places in particular, picked up on these conspiracy theories and picked them up. So with the researchers are learning that really the mass media and social media are actually very, very integrated. Mm-hmm. They're not sort of two separate things anymore. And what's happened now, obviously, is Trump has been cut off. He's no longer tweeting, or at least not on the accounts that he used to have. And what's happened is really interesting is that as soon as Trump stopped, you know, so Twitter banned Trump, Facebook and YouTube and also and other places have suspended Trump's accounts, the conversation was almost immediately stifled. Yeah, so the team researchers analyzed networks of influential Twitter users and found that an entire section tied to QAnon disappeared virtually overnight. And so it was as if he'd built up this sort of groundswell of support, but it was on a very, very fragile foundation. And as soon as he left, or he was stifled, then everything collapsed. Mm. Yeah. And so these conspiracy theories, he obviously pushed them into the limelight, but as soon as he was gone, they went away. And researchers are still analyzing mountains and mountains of data. But it's already clear that new regulations will be needed to govern the internet, some of the tech giants, and the content their users post online to stop this happening again.
It's a very interesting phenomenon.
It sort of shows the power of like platform companies now as well, because with Trump, he no longer had to go through the middleman like the media. He could tweet directly to his followers, and I guess it shows just how influential that can be.
That's right. And it seems like what they thought they were doing by trying to control the conversation wasn't really working very well.
Mm.
All right, well, next up is all about mammals and birds. Care to tell us what this is all about?
Yeah, so let's say you were living in, you were either a small mammal or a bird, and you were living in an environment that was fairly arid, like a desert. And the world is warming around you. Which would you prefer to be? This is a question for you guys.
Ooh, probably be a bird.
Yeah, I think I'd want to be a bird because you could sort of leave.
Well, it's an interesting question because obviously the world is warming, and there's been studies on how habitat is changing and how that is affecting populations of different species. And so in the early 1900s, a naturalist called Joseph Grinnell went into the wilds of California in the Mojave Desert, and he surveyed what wildlife he found. And he made very, very interesting detailed records of what he found. And now we're going back into these areas, and we're able to compare his really detailed records, which are a great record of what was existing more than 100 years ago, to what ecologists are finding today. And the Mojave has warmed about 2 degrees Celsius over the last century. And bird numbers, mammal numbers have declined dramatically, but there is some good news for one of those species. I'll keep you on the edge of your seats for a few seconds longer. So there's definitely winners and losers here. And the researchers in the last sort of 3 or 4 years definitely found that bird populations have collapsed quite markedly. So there's a new lower number of species found per sort of site in these regions. And so on average, every spot surveyed had lost more than 40% of its desert bird species over the last 100 years or so. And these are American kestrels, mountain quail, and other species. And across the board, all species were scarcer. But a more recent study led by Iowa State University found that there's a sort of a hopeful story for small mammals like rats, mice, chipmunks, and other small mammals. And it seems like although these species have declined, a bunch of them, about 27 of them, remained fairly stable And four have actually increased in number, so that some of these small mammal species are doing better. And so they tried to figure out why. And so they spent a couple of years measuring how birds and mammals react to the heat, to the absorption of light, their fur and feathers, and try to understand what was going on here. And they fed those numbers into the data on the species and into a computer program that modeled how much heat stress an animal would be exposed to and how well it could cool itself under different temperature conditions. Now, to keep cool, birds must expend energy. Both are warm-blooded, obviously they have to regulate their temperature. Birds must expend energy by dilating blood vessels to evaporate moisture from their legs or their mouths. And the energetic costs of cooling in birds were more than three times higher than in mammals. Yeah, and this is because small mammals have one major advantage over birds in that they can burrow. They can take refuge underground during the hardest parts of the day. So they can sort of escape. And only mammals that find themselves in soil that's sort of really too shallow to provide much cooling, such as a species called the cactus mouse, those species suffered from the heat.
Right.
But other species actually did okay. In contrast, birds such as the kestrel, prairie falcon, are exposed to the full brunt of the heating, and they can't really get away that easily. So they can't actually fly out of the desert so easily. This is good for mammals, but it does hint at a loss of diversity in these habitats. There's worrying signs that this may be replicated for deserts across the globe as temperatures are rising. And it's not all good news for mammals, too, because they may be at risk in the future. Thin soils cover just about 2% of the deserts today, but such areas are expected to grow as deserts get more arid. Mm. And so even the small mammals won't escape.
Yeah, so it's less of a question of who benefits from warming, more so who gets fucked over the least.
Basically, yes.
Yeah. All right, so lastly, a new spacecraft has reached Mars.
Yes, so a spacecraft called HOPE arrived at Mars, I think, yesterday. And this is one of three missions that are going to arrive at Mars this year. It inserted itself into orbit around the planet. That involved a 30-minute burn of the spacecraft's thrusters to slow it down from 121,000 kilometers per hour, which is fairly fast, to about 18,000 kilometers per hour. So it's captured by the gravity, and it'll maneuver over the next few months into an elliptical orbit that varies from about 20,000 to 43,000 kilometers above the planet. And it's going to take lots of pictures in the ultraviolet and in the infrared and an imaging camera that will capture how dust storms start and evolve and how the atmosphere reacts to changes in space weather, such as solar storms. And they'll also shed light on how hydrogen and oxygen gases migrate up from lower atmospheres and escape into space. Scientists are very excited about this, but one thing I haven't mentioned is where this probe came from. Obviously, it came from Earth, but who launched it? And it's not America, it's not Russia, and it's actually the United Arab Emirates in their first big planetary mission, and the first planetary mission from an Arab nation. And it's really generating a lot of excitement in the region, and scientists hope that this is going to sort of push young people in the region to get into science and these sort of thing and these sort of missions. And it is the first of three. So China's probe is due to arrive on the 10th of February. And that's the first probe from China to get to Mars. And then the US, NASA's Perseverance rover, will join on 18th of February. So everyone's basically arriving at the same time. Mm. China's mission has an orbiter, lander, and rover. NASA has a rover, I think, yes. So everyone's arriving at the same time, and this is just because of the relative orbits of Earth and Mars, there's a sort of a sweet spot where they're closer.
Mm.
Yeah,
it's a big step in space exploration, though.
Definitely. Absolutely, and I think New Zealand should get in on the party too.
Yeah. All right, well, that's Dear Science. Thank you so much, Marcus, for joining us, and thank you very much to MOTAT, as always.
Thank you, MOTAT.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.